Today is Friday, September 16th, once again at the Urbana Free Library. Jeff Machota here for the Nature's Table Oral History Project, and today with Brad Wheeler. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Jeff.
So, Brad, wanted to start with what brought you to Champaign-Urbana? What was your educational history, your musical history, whatever? What brought you here and when?
Okay. I was a child actor at first when I was in sixth grade, and when I was in eighth grade, I was working the show called Oliver at Candlelight Theater.
In Chicago.
Chicago suburbs in, let's see, eight shows a week for 6 months. So I was already really into, you know, singing and dancing and Broadway theater and stuff. And at the same time, I was, you know, started off at alto sax, and then I went to summer youth music choral camp when I was in sixth grade. And then I saw the Garvey Band with Ron Dewar and a lot of the greats at the MENC convention in Omaha, Nebraska, and Dewar just blew me away. And then I was in his big band in eighth grade at the Summer Youth Music Jazz Camp. And again, you know, he just had a big, he still has a big influence on me.
What years would that have been?
Well, that was, 74.
74.
Something like that. But then, so in high school, I you know, took lessons, and I studied with Joe Daly, who was a great teacher and great saxophonist in Chicago. And he has a method that's very strong. Mike Coker also studied with him. And so I, you know, by the time I was done with senior year, I had a strong technique and a good foundation for jazz playing. And I, you know, knew I was, wanted to study music. And I wanted to study composition at the University of Illinois, not because I didn't really know any of the composers then, or I just knew Ron was down there, and you know, so I became a music major in 1978.
So stepping back a minute, so you said at a young age you were an actor into that. What got you into that? Was it parents, uncle?
No,
whatever.
I don't remember why I got into it. I was musical. I had a really good voice then, before my voice changed. And
so did grade school have a good program? Was that
no? I mean, I was in the band. I think what happened? Yeah, at Riverside Brookfield High School, they were looking for kids because they were doing Oliver, so they wanted. Junior high kids, and then neighbor told us about it or something, and I went and auditioned and did that, and then I did some more theater in seventh grade and eighth grade again. Then in eighth grade I did Oliver at Candlelight Theater, so it was just, you know, and also I listened a lot. Okay, there were classical records my mother listened to. So, and I listened to some pop music on the radio, but mostly I get into jazz right away, you know, Sonny Stitt, Ben Webster, Coleman Hawkins, and then eventually, you know, later on, in high school, I got a jazz history book, and I read the whole, it was by a German guy, and read the whole thing, and really started to understand the history of jazz, and you know, got hooked on Bird and Coltrane and Sonny Rollins and all the rest of it. I also went to Jamie Abusall Jazz Camps in 76 and 77, and Dave Liebman was there, Joe Henderson, Woody Shaw, a host, I think Howie Smith was there, and a host of great teachers and players, and it was, you know, so I didn't know any thing about harmony or anything, but I was really blown away. So anyway,
So 78, you come down here. So what was the School of Music like? What was Champaign-Urbana like? What was the U of I?
It was great. I remember the first day I got down here, I was walking, just walking down Green Street, and I was walking the wrong way at first. And then I turned around and went where the action was. And, you know, it was like 52nd Street or something. There was, you know, Zorba's had bands, and later on there would be Mabel's, and the, what is it, the Red Lion? Was there, no, not Red Lion. Red.
That was up there, yeah, the Red so, Lion was.
Anyway, there was, you know, a lot of live music going on, and it was really exciting. You know, Ron DeWar was playing hot music, and I never really got into that, but, it, you know, I started to get into it because of him. And a lot of people were hanging out and having fun and really digging the music, you know. And Zorba's had a really beat-up piano then, and there was this one piano player, I can't remember his name, but he used to beat the hell out of the piano. But I think he used to play there every Monday or maybe Thursday. Or I don't remember exactly. Thursday, I suppose. And, you know, and then I remember also Joel Spencer coming down with Eric Schneider. And Eric, they both, I know Eric had just got off the, he had just got off the Earl Hines band. And I think Joel was on that band too for a minute. I'm pretty sure. And I knew Joel because I went to Orphans before I came to U of I. Orphans is a jazz club in Chicago. And Joe Daly, my teacher, would play there every Monday with John Campbell and Steve Laspina and Joel. And one day, and the drinking age was 18 then, so I could sneak in usually. And so, you know, it was usually hardly anyone there. So, you know, I could talk to the cats, and I talked to Joel, who's always very friendly. And I said, yeah, I'm going to U of I. He goes, oh, I just graduated from there. And so eventually at this jam session, I think it was a Thursday night or maybe a Friday night, at Zorba's. Everyone was hanging out, Joel, and maybe Eric wasn't there, it was just Joel. And I got to sit in with him, and it's the first time I played with Joel, and I was really scared, you know. But, you know, I held my own, I guess, and that was the beginning of a long and current friendship.
So at that point, Zorba's was doing more than just the hot music. They were
having
music more often.
Oh, yeah. It was. They had jazz there a lot. I don't remember if it was every night, but it seemed like it.
What other places had music at the time?
Well,
or jazz.
Mabel's came later, I think a year later. And
they were a jazz club at first.
Well, they had all kinds of stuff, but Ron used to play there a lot with Mike Friedman and Neil Milosevic. Nick. Nick Milosevic and Jim Cox. And he played, you know, I got some tapes of that. I mean, Ron was in his prime. He just was, I think, well, it's my own personal opinion, but I think he's, you know, one of my favorite tenor players, bar none. You know, he influenced me a lot. And I'm still blown away by those tapes, you know. And
so who were you studying with right off the bat when you came here?
Okay, well, when I came, I was a composition major. So, but, you know, who knows anything about 20th century music when you're 18 years old? Not too much, you know. I just knew that there was no jazz program, and I wasn't going to be a classical saxophonist. That's like the ultimate insult. At least that's what I thought at the time. And so, you know, somehow, you know, I remember auditioning, and they asked me all these stupid questions, and I didn't know anything. But they seemed to like me anyway. So I think they liked me because I was a jazzer. They knew I was a jazzer. And a lot of the faculty, if not jazzers, I mean, were sympathetic to it. And there was also a history of, like, Ron DeWar was a composition major. I think Jim McNeely might have been a composition major. So there was a history of the jazzers and the new music cats hanging out and getting into trouble together and making great music together. And so I had this group composition class, and my teacher was Sal Martirano. So he walks in smoking Benson and Hedges, of course, and he looks around and he points to me. He goes, "You're a jazzer." I said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay." And I don't remember much, you know, he told us to write melodies or something. That was not, you know, class that I didn't make any breakthroughs, but I met Sal, and that was the important thing. He was a great pianist, in, like, in the style of 40s bebop and kind of monkish. He met Monk. He's a New Yorker. And he's a genius composer. And I remember being in, I had a synthesizer called a Lyricon at the time, and we put together a synthesizer ensemble, and we did a concert with the Salmar Construction, which is this huge analog digital orchestra, that he electronic orchestra that he created.
I saw some performances of that later.
Right. So before Nature's Table, it was just Green Street, pretty much. And I remember seeing Sun Ra. It was, I think it was it the Red Line?
Panama Reds.
I saw Sun Ra there. That was great. And
how about Trino's? Was there anything?
Oh, yeah, Trino's, of course. The big bands were always playing there. And Ron was playing there with his quartet.
So Ron wasn't at school at that point.
No, he was like he was 40 years old, but he was going through some time, you know, troubles, and so Garvey would hire him as an adjunct faculty to play in the big band eventually, and teach some private lessons and stuff, but. Oh yeah, Trino's. Joan Hickey and I played there. I think we had a quintet called Out of Nowheres, and it was Joan and I and Steve Thomas on trumpet, and I think Stitely on drums, and I don't remember the bass player, Karen Korsmeyer maybe. I don't know, but anyway. I got a great story about Jeff Stately, another drummer, maybe the house drummer at Nature's Table, all in all. We were both living in Newman Hall, which was a Catholic dorm. And so at dinner time, I saw him with his drumsticks. And I said, "Oh, are you a drummer? Do you play jazz? Sit down." So kind of browbeat him, and then I said, "Hey, you want to go listen to some Coltrane?" He said, "Okay." I took him up to my room, and I put on Interstellar Space, which was like one of his last records, completely free jazz. I'm sure Stitely remembers that. It was, you know, a great initiation to my world, which I wanted to be Coltrane. You know, no, I was totally into Coltrane and, you know, trying to figure it out, you know, because there was no jazz harmony classes. Although I knew music theory was easy because I just translated all the figured bass into jazz notation. And so, anyway, eventually a Nature's Table opened and...
So Nature's Table opened, Terry opened it September of 79, and it was just a coffee house, cafe kind
of place. And you said there was no music until 80? You
didn't do music till early 1980, either January or February, I'm not exactly sure.
Well, then
Do you remember going by there at all before it was doing music, or how did you first hear about it?
I don't know, word of mouth. Um, You know, I don't remember the first. Well, I must have heard Dewar there. Must have.
Well, the first, I believe, the first band. The story Terry told me, and then Shelley told me as well. So Shelley started hanging out there. Shelley took Terry to go see the Jack Webb Band over at Ground Round. And Terry was blown away, wanted to know who Jack Webb was, which one was Jack Webb, and then booked the band. That was going to be the first band to play.
But before it was called Jack Webb, it was called...
Memphis Nighthawks?
No, Mysterious Babies.
I think it was the Jack Webb Band at the time that he saw him, because it would have been right around 70, 80 or so. And then he booked them, and they were going to be the first band, and then... Dave Dreyer heard about it, and Dave Dreyer and Brian Wilkie, I think, played first because they heard about the place opening up. Then when Terry and Shelley got a piano. So from early on, Dewar was playing there from pretty much the first day.
Well, yeah, it's no surprise. So I must have heard him because I'd follow him around.
Did you?
But I remember, you know, I remember him, you know, at Mabel's a lot, and so and.
How about Morgan Powell and Ray Sasaki? Did you run to them?
Well, of course. You know, my second semester, I was in Ray's second band, and that was great. That was really fun. And he was also doing a lot of transcribing then. So I started transcribing in the summers when I would go back home, and I would spend the summer. I had a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and I could slow things down half speed to get it really accurate. So I did a lot of really hard stuff, you know, modern stuff.
What kind of stuff?
Michael Brecker solos, some Dave Liebman, Live at the Lighthouse, some Sonny Rollins and Sonny Stitt. Oh, Johnny Griffin's rhythming solo from Live at the Five Spot, which I later gave to him when I played with him. And I can't remember what else, but, you know, I did my transcribing in two summers, and that was influenced by Ray.
No. So you heard about the table, so you should. Do you remember your first time hanging out or first impressions?
I don't remember. I mean, I just became, you know, whenever Ron was playing there, I'm sure I was there just about. And especially I remember seeing him play trio with Joel and Kelly. And that was really spectacular. I had tapes of that, but I lost them somewhere.
So Joel was already in Chicago at that point, or was he still living down? So no. He was coming back to play gigs at the table.
Yes. Eventually, John Campbell and Joel and Kelly would come down and play with Ron, and those would be we were just like total groupies, you know. The place was packed, and it was a big party. We had a jazz house. And press pause for a minute. So we had this jazz house at 704 Illinois Street. Me and Stitely and Pete Lewis and Steve Griggs and Tim Lukoci.
What did Pete play?
Pete played alto sax. And Steve played alto and later tenor with John Scott. And so we'd have wild parties there, and you know, and also, you know, Lynn Holiday and Bebop Sam Thomas were in town, and Guido, so they'd come over, and boy, I mean.
So this was before the table, or right when the table was starting?
This was about the same time, my third, I spent 2 years, first 2 years at Newman Hall, and then we got this jazz house, so the beginning of our junior year.
So that would have been, the table would have been happening already. So do you remember the first time you met Terry? Or an early memory of Terry?
I know I was scared of him a little bit because I wanted to get my own gigs, but I think he liked me. Well, I know he liked me. Like I said, my first gig there, I thought it was pretty early, so it might have been October of 80, and it was with Joan, and it was a quartet, and I remember playing Prince of Darkness, Miles Davis tune. And, you know, that was a big deal because it was like my gig, and, you know.
So your first gig there was as a leader?
Yeah.
So it was you and Joan Hickey on piano. Who else do you think?
I can't remember the drummer. And
Stitely?
No. Yeah. It was a percussion major, hot shot percussion major. And I don't remember who was playing bass either. Anyway, so I must have asked Terry before that for the gig, obviously. And I don't know. I mean, I remember one, I think it was in the summertime. I don't remember what year, but his athleticism was amazing. It was this, you know, the counter where you order the food, you know, it was only about, you know, how much space like that, you know, a couple, 2-3 feet. And I saw him jump feet first through that into the kitchen.
And the kitchen was down.
Yes. It's crazy. I don't know how he did that. Nuts. But anyway, yeah.
So when you first started playing there, so the physical layout shifted.
Right. First
was... So it was on the, what would be the...
entrance first on the left as you walked in.
On the south
and
side.
And then later they moved it to the right.
So when you were playing there first off, you were on the south side. Mm-hmm. So you somehow met Terry because you asked him. Do you remember meeting Shelley at all? Or
she was, you know, pregnant a lot then, and, you know, she had her little entourage of dancers, and it was perfect. I mean, it fit in perfectly. I don't think anyone thought it was weird or anything. We liked it when they were dancing, you know, and, you know, soon it was like, you know, the place to go whenever you wanted to find out what was going on. You know.
So it appears that Zorba's then stopped doing music around that time. You
think? I don't remember. By
1985 or 1984 fall, Zorba's, this is when I came here, Zorba's wasn't doing jazz. Mm-hmm. Panama Reds was gone. Red Lion was gone.
Yeah.
Abel's was doing rock. Red Herring was mostly doing folk stuff.
Nature's Table was the jazz place.
And only Trino's would just do the big band on Tuesday nights.
Right.
So when did you leave town? When did you graduate? Or did you graduate?
Fall of 83.
So in that period between 80 and 83, you played quite a few times at the table?
No.
No.
Well, I might have, but I was busy making my way into the Chicago scene, and in August of 84, Joel started his organ trio with Mike Coker, and so we rehearsed and we made a record, and...
And you were all in Chicago at the time?
Yeah, no, Coker was still down here.
Okay.
And... So we played some gigs around Chicago, and then we would come down and play Nature's Table. But it's also around 1985. I booked two nights. I asked Ed Peterson if he wanted to do a two tenor thing at Nature's Table with his group. It was Coker and Dan DiLorenzo and Stitely, I think. And so I booked that gig, and then Ed asked me to join his band, so I did for a year and a half, every Monday night at the Green Mill.
So you were Ned Peterson's band.
Yes. Okay. And but let's go back before that. I mean, sure. Some great. I remember playing a gig probably 81, summer of 81, summer youth music, and Tom Schaub Wirtle was down, and he was a big influence on me, and...
In which way? In what way?
Well, he was teaching 1 year when I first got to U of I, and I don't know, he's just so open-minded and lovable, and he was, you know, knew a lot about music. He gave me all of his scores to look over, and he was a great big band writer, and he was in the Jazz Members Big Band, and when I was 19, I got into the Jazz Members Big Band, and that was a real big deal. Well, I was subbing, and then...
The Jazz Members Big Band was in Chicago.
Yes. That was all mostly U of I alumni band of the people that moved up there. And so I was going back and forth with Mark Curry, who's the lead trumpet player in the Garvin band. We'd go up and play Fitzgerald's every Sunday. So it was, you know, I was doing a lot of, wasn't doing a whole lot of composing, although I was writing tunes and teaching myself jazz harmony that way. But I was doing a lot of playing, you know. And so during the summer, you know, it was a great session. It was Mike Friedman and me and Schaub and Dandy Lorenzo and Sal. Wow. And that was really a good night. And other big nights, well, of course, anytime the John Campbell Trio came down and played with Ron was exceptional. Also, when Dave Lieben came and played with John Campbell's Trio, that twice, and that was incredible too. And I knew right then and there I wanted to study with Dave Lieben because I knew he was a good teacher. And in 86, 87, I got a National Endowment for the Arts grant to go to New York and study with him, and I did. And I also was the first one to book him into the Green Mill with Joel and Kelly and Jim Trompeter. And later, Jim McNeely played. So, what else?
So when you were still an undergrad, you were playing at the table, you were going to Chicago, you were just playing a lot,
yeah.
So what were the crowds at the table like? Did people come? Were there certain gigs that
had a lot? It varied, you know. I mean, I had, you know, some groupies that liked my experimentation. You know, I was trying, the outer the better, you know. It's like late train, trying to figure out a chromatic way of playing that I eventually learned from.
You had some band with Doug Tiedebeck?
Yeah, we had Ancient Babies. That was a great band. Tiedebeck and Jeff Beer and Larry Beers and Dan Anderson. And we played Ornette Coleman music and Anthony Braxton tune and this tune called Slave Ship. And so that was, you know, we were all hippied out. That was my hippie period. And it was a great band. I played, you know, soprano and tenor and bass clarinet in that band. And it was fun. But that was 82, I think. 82.
So was it worth Joel and them coming back to play at the table? Did they play just because they liked it, or was it actually...
Well, they liked it. The audience was great. I mean, we hung on every note. And they made decent money. Same with the Joel Spencer group, organ band. We always made decent, you know. I think Terry gave us a guarantee or something. And Joel was a pretty shrewd businessman. But Terry was also shrewd, but, you know, warm-hearted. And you know, we drew people. So, you know, it was always special, cats coming down from Chicago. You know, they don't do that so much anymore. I guess they can't make enough money, but...
So when did you first meet Lawrence Hobgood?
Freshman year, he was in my theory class. I'm pretty sure that was it. And he's going to hate me for this, but honestly, he was the guy that had all the chops in the world and no taste. And Coker, I was waiting for Coker to come down anyway because I knew he was coming. He was like a year or two behind me. I knew he was coming soon. And I was, you know, I was pretty arrogant. I mean, I was auditioning people for my band. Yeah, and it was, you know, and people put up with it. You know, it's pretty funny. Doc Scott reminded me of that, you know. And anyway, Lawrence, so mostly Coker was my man. But I had one project where Lawrence eventually lived a summer in our house, and then we moved to another house, and he had like a separate apartment in the backyard. So, you know, easy to get stoned and listen to VSOP, you know, or whatever. And so he was in his own world and I was in my own world, and I was, you know, in my, I just thought I was ahead of him. Because I was in first band real quick, you know, but of course there's, you know, only one piano player and at least two tenor players, so, you know. But anyway, I was on top of things, and he was, but he, you know, I had a project where I had this open form piece where I just kind of explained in a general fashion how things were going to go. It was a band with Mike Cherry on trumpet, and me and Lawrence, I think, played Rhodes, Coker and Lawrence, and I don't remember, maybe they switched off, but it was Rhodes and piano, and Dan and Stitely, I think.
What kind of stuff were you doing?
It was this open form piece that I created, you know, so I would say, okay, we're going to start off in a certain key, and then we're going to go into a Latin feel here or a swing feel, and eventually.
Was this a table gig or was this?
It was a table gig. Okay. Yeah, it was one of my little projects, and that was a lot of fun. And then I split. I went up to Chicago, and Lawrence stayed. He had regular steady gigs, and he just kept getting better and better. He came to Chicago in 89, and I started playing with him and liked it. And then I split again to Paris, and he stayed and met Gerdeling, and the rest is history.
Well, I didn't bring the later posters, but there's at least one when Lawrence came back and you were on the gigs.
Lawrence came back and
It was called like The Return or whatever. Lawrence played some gigs at the table with you on them. So maybe late 80s? You don't remember that?
Well, no, I don't remember that.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'll have to look it up. I think I have it. Well, so you left town, but you still came back to play at the table because you were playing with Joel.
I played with Joel and had my own bands. Ed Peterson's group, any excuse to come back down was good enough for me.
Did you ever play any gigs with Sal at the table?
Just that one that I already told you about. I can't remember it. I would usually use Coker. Because Sal, I mean, he was brilliant, but, you know, he would goof up the form sometimes, and he didn't seem to care, but I cared. Anyway, he was busy doing his thing, and I was. No, Coker was the man. Because Coker, you know, I thought could play like McCoy Tyner or, you know, or Herbie or whatever. And so he fit. And also, you know, I was infatuated with Dave Liebman and Richard Bierack, their duo, and their, you know, tightness. So in my mind then, Coker was my Richard Bierack. And what's ironic is later on, Lawrence turned into the piano player that I really, you know, he's on my CD, and he's the cat that really understands me just about, well, Chip Stevens really understands me. You know, I really like playing with him. But Lawrence, you know, got me. He knew where I was going to go harmonically, and it was pretty exciting.
So you met Doc Scott at the table?
Yes.
So do you remember any early memories of meeting him?
I would think it was during the summer again. He had, you know, it was this doctor guy. I mean, didn't impress me at first. And then someone told me that, you know, he was friends with Herbie Hancock or something. That seemed hard to believe, too. But then, you know, when he played, it was like, wow, this guy is really, really great. But I guess I played a few gigs on these sheets with Doc, but not too much, you know. By the time he got his band together, I was already on my way out, and Steve Griggs was playing with him. So, but I did play with him like in '89 before I went to Paris, and it could have been a great gig. I mean, but he got pissed off and felt like he didn't play good and blah blah blah. So it was still a great gig anyway.
Because he used Coker a lot when he could.
Yeah.
Early on. So what?
But I played a gig with Frank Mantooth at the table. I played, but there was other good piano players. Can't remember all their names anymore, but.
So as you were starting to play more gigs in Chicago and still living down here and then coming back and saw more and more clubs, what was the table? Was the table different than those? Were there similarities? What made Nature's Table unique? Or what made it not unique and just a regular club?
Well, Terry let us play whatever we wanted, and he pretty loose, I think. You know, I don't think anyone tried to take advantage of him. You know, he could put his foot down when he had to, but he didn't have to very often, I don't think. It was just fun, you know. I mean, I didn't really want to leave Champaign-Urbana. My dad got sick and had to go home. You know, I didn't finish. I did my composition recital in '85. Hmm. You know, I couldn't write contemporary music while I was down here because I was, you know, all the teachers had me looking for some kind of mathematical algorithm that would write music for me, and I couldn't get it. So I finally went home and took care of my dad and started freelancing in Chicago and started writing classical music, you know. And I'm still doing it today, trying.
So did you ever go in the daytime to the table? Did you ever eat food there?
Sure. Lunch, I remember when, I think it was 81 maybe. Or maybe Sal went to IRCOM in Paris for 6 months. And so he wasn't around. And but the lunchtime, you know, all the professors used to come there. And, you know, I would always, I mean, that was the place to hang out, you know, and be intellectual, you know.
Do you remember any of the employees?
Amy Evenson. And
so she worked in the kitchen.
Yeah. I guess I didn't pay very much attention to you. But yeah, I mean, it was always some pretty.
Well, I didn't show up there until '85. So.
Oh, I was gone by then. No,
I started hanging out in '84.
I got a good excuse then.
Amy, I think, was still there. She was on her, a lot of people were on their way out when I came in.
Right.
A lot of people were graduating or leaving town or going to the West Coast or Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, I was in my own world. I didn't really hang out with the help. I remember doing a free improv with Shelley, but it wasn't at the table. It was at...
White Street?
No. Right around the Red Herring. There was a hall there. They used to have concerts. Anyway, we would do some free dance music stuff.
So just sax and...
Sax and dance, yeah. That was pretty intense. I mean, we did some good stuff, but... we're just fooling around, I guess. I don't remember doing anything in public. But, you know, she was part of the scene. All the teachers by then were hanging out. You know, the students, teachers would hang out and party a lot. And at Sal's house or at Morgan and Ray's. And it was fun. It was a great time.
So as you saw other clubs, you said Terry let things happen more, so other clubs were tighter and didn't let people do
it. Well, some of them were. I don't know. The Green Mill is a great place. I mean, that's another great club. And it was a place called Oz. That's where the organ band played regularly. And Oz was very fair.
Yeah, but these are both Chicago clubs, yeah. Green Mill and Oz.
Right. And it was quite a few clubs in Chicago. But Nature's Table, Champaign, Urbana is a lot looser, you know, and it's just fun to get away from the city and play a couple nights in a row, usually two nights in a row. But
so at that point, there was... People came to the U of I to study with Garv or to play with Ron, and some of them, and after a certain period of time, played at Nature's Table, then a lot of them ended up in the Chicago scene. So there was a lot of people that were, they would come back then to play gigs more often.
Right. Yep.
So what changed? When you came back from Paris, didn't you say things were very different in Chicago?
They're different here, too. You know, the Champaign, when I was an undergrad, was still at the end of its hippie period. And by the 90s, it got corporated. You know, a lot of the Green Streets got repaired, you know, and just... I don't know. Everything got more expensive. Students had to go to class. Professors had to show up to class. Less and less student-professor partying. Different world. And Chicago, yeah, well... Well, I mean, you know, the jazz clubs closed and all over the world, and just it wasn't as good as the 80s or the 70s. So can't do anything about that.
So any more thoughts on role of Nature's Table, how it influenced or impacted you?
Well, it gave me a place to do my thing, you know, and to make my name and to play my compositions and to do whatever I wanted, really, and play with great musicians and just, you know, musicians, they need a place to play. Jazz musicians need a place to play. It's practicing at home. It's not the same thing. And it's not a satisfying audience, is needed. You know. So, I mean, it was a fraternity. It was friendships that lasted still, you know, lasting friendships 30 years or more. Probably, I'm sure, you know, the rest of my life. You know, and in 1994, I went to Eastwood School of Music to do my master's degree, and I thought, oh, this is going to be great. I already know a lot of this shit, and it's going to be like U of I all over again. Well, it wasn't. Rochester is not Champaign-Urbana, and even though I did know a lot of stuff because I was older, it made me work my butt off. So it wasn't as much. Well, some of the music was great, but it was kind of a lonely place. The school is fantastic, but the great thing about Champaign-Urbana is there's always been a place for students to play. That's really important outside of the school. I think it's really important. I think it's unique. I mean, I don't think too many other jazz programs have something like that going. But I'm sure there is somewhere. But it's always been a great music town. Renee's Table is part of it. You know, it's too bad they had to knock it down. It was really a great cultural center for not just musicians, but artists and professors. Perfect location across from Cranert, two blocks away from the music building. You know, it was ground zero for creation. And Terry and Shelley just let it happen. And then
well, that sounds like a good place to end.
Yeah, I'm sure I can think of more stories. You know, I remember, let's see, Rufus Reed's group coming down with now I can't remember the names of cats. It was a New York group, really great.
Got a recording of it.
Yeah.
Like you played
Bob Rockwell on tenor, and
he played three nights, I think.
Yeah, I made tapes of it too. It was really great, and really great drummer. I can't remember his name.
So, when you know Liebman and stuff coming, those are pretty big names.
Yeah,
and Rufus Reed and Nature's Table wasn't a big place.
No, but it was, you know, if they got it to Chicago, it was an easy and fun place to come and do a gig, you know. So Lee would do, this was before Green Mill, so he would do a night or two at whatever clubs in Chicago, and then he'd come down and do two nights here. So that, you know, it's four nights in a row, and that's a nice little.
So earlier you mentioned Len Halliday and Bebop Sam.
Right.
Did you play with them at all?
Yes.
Or hang out?
Bebop and Len would teach me some tunes, and he was practicing a lot. You know, I'd run into him in the music school, in the practice rooms.
So he was a Chicago guy who came down here for a couple years.
Yeah, to try out, I guess. And Bebop Sam, he was kind of scary. He had some eye problems, but he was wonderful too. And when I went back to Chicago and I played gigs with him, he hired me on some really nice gigs.
And he was a guitar player.
Yes. And
how was he scary?
Oh, he had a bad eye. He looked, you know, these were all junkies, you know, ex-junkies or whatever. And but I mean, you know, they were, you know, it was part of the jazz dream is to get to hang out with junkies. Okay, Bird was a junkie, so, you know, we hung out with, these guys were real. They were real, I mean.
Did you ever play with Guido? Or?
Yeah, I played with Guido. I gave him my alto. It was one, I think it must have been around 1980 or something. Really hard winter, and Guido's down in the dumps. So he had his beat-up horn, and I traded my nice horn for his old beat-up horn. And so he wrote me a tune called Wheels Rhapsody.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, I don't regret giving him that, you know. And Lynn would play with Ron. There's some great tapes of that. Really great tenor battles. So, that was, you know, that made Champagne very, very cool also, you know.
So Ron seems to have been a lot of the early glue.
Oh,
God. That people gravitated
around. He's the genius, yeah. The force. You know, follow him around with a tape recorder. Total fan. Still.
So what about his playing attracts you?
Everything. I mean, genius lines, beautiful singing lines. Out playing, you know, just total mastery of the horn, big sound. Just unbelievable technique, but not flashy, you know, to be flashy. Just every solo was like perfect. And he wouldn't agree with me on that, but too bad. And then he'd go turn around and play hot music. Jeez, I had a band called the Shambana Stompers with Tom Flanagan and Doug Tiedebach and Dan Anderson and Stigley. And
that band played at the table, right?
Yes, we played quite a bit. And I can't remember the banjo player. Oh, anyway.
What did you play in that, clarinet or
soprano? Clarinet and soprano. And you know, it was okay. You know, I'll never be a great hot player like Ron. It takes a lot of work. You know, it's completely different than bebop. And but you know, I had to do everything Ron did. That's all there is to it. I was little Ron. I played. You know, Sal wrote Ron a piece called Underworld, an avant-garde piece, in 1964 for Ron. And well, I was studying with Sal one day, and I was asking him about it, and he goes, you want to play it? I said, yeah. Okay. And we got it together. Stigley was in it. And,
I saw a video of that when I was an undergrad.
Yeah, we made a video. It's great. So
I was taking a class at Allen Hall. And
I'm glad I did pretty good justice to that piece, you know. Be fun to do it with Ron. That would be fun, but I don't think that's gonna happen.
So Sal wrote that for Ron.
Mm-hmm. And Chuck Brogham and the guys that were around in 1964.
So were you in Garv's band?
Yes.
Any memories of that?
Sophomore year on. Oh yeah, well. The morale was really good in that band. We all, you know, we did crazy, stupid things, but the music was great, so we could get away with it. And
who was in that band at the time?
Well, Pete Lewis was lead sax, lead alto. Steve Griggs was second alto. When I first got in, it was Larry Gianeski. And I was playing second tenor, and Bill Overton was playing first tenor. And then, but that was for one semester. And then Ron played first tenor for a year, I think.
Oh, so you were in the band with Ron?
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was just me. He'd take solos and he'd fall out of your chair, you know. And then I got to be first tenor. And, you know, Dan Anderson was playing tuba and Mark Curry was playing lead trumpet. And Bill, Bill was playing piano. I can't remember.
So you went from Garv's band, and the next year you were in Ray Sasaki's band?
No. I started in Tom Berkner's third band for one semester, then Ray Sasaki's, this was when I was a freshman, then Ray Sasaki's band for the second semester, and then my beginning of sophomore year I was in the first band. Garvey was on sabbatical, and so Ray had the first band. Hmm. And that was kind of weird because it was still like the old Garvey band with Ray, and some, I don't know, it should have been great. It was great, but it was, there were some weird attitudes. And then Garvey came back the second semester of my sophomore year. And from then on, I was in the Garvey band. So,
well, any final thoughts? Any final table comments?
I wish there was another Nature's Table in Champaign-Urbana right now. Iron Post is great, but we need another place, you know. But you never know. Maybe something good will happen.
All right. Well, thanks, Brad. And we'll...